Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Good morning. This morning we're speaking with Dr. Les Ruppersberger. He's written a new book on the creation of the beautiful creation of babies. And he's also here to talk to us today about the upcoming March for Life. Welcome, Les.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Well, let's talk first of all about this year's March for Life and the theme and what's going on and what St. Ignatius is doing actually to bring people to the march.
Respect Life Committee has procured a bus, and apparently they were a little bit more difficult to get this year than in other years, and I suspect that a large part of that may be the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, and a lot of parishes and organizations and groups are planning celebrations for that throughout the year. I'm aware of at least three or four of them that are planned for later in the year. And we're now running on 45 years since Roe v. Wade, and this is the 44th annual March for Life, and I think there's just a lot more movement and a lot more interest, especially among the young groups, and that's manifested in our St. Ignatius Respect Life, and that I received a contact from one of the ministry leaders at Conwell Egan High School requesting that we provide them with 15 seats for their students to go down. So this will be the first time that we're actually hosting some high school students. We've traditionally tried to get some of our grade school students to go down with us annually, and a couple of years ago they did, but I think some of the difficulties with getting the parents to go and the teachers getting out of school and getting off have created those problems, so we've not been able to get some of the older students to go. But a lot of parents bring their children, so we're working on, we're up to 42 seats that are now taken or spoken for out of the 54-seat bus, so we have a few left, so anyone out there listening that may be looking for a seat, the march this year is January 19th, and Sanctity of Life Sunday will be January 21st, 2 days later. And we will be leaving. We have a 7:15 Traveler's Mass at St. Ignatius, and then we'll be leaving around 8 a.m. and returning around 8 p.m. on Friday evening. We stop for dinner on the way back. They modified the march route this year again, so it's going to start at 12th and Constitution, right near the Washington Monument, and the keynote speaker this year is Stephanie Gray, and so she's an exciting individual who's very charismatic in her public speaking style, and she has written and spoken and traveled extensively throughout the United States and Canada promoting the pro-life message. And so we're all looking forward to going down. We have refreshments on the bus. We usually sell a movie or two, one on the way down, one on the way back, pray the rosary, have some time to rest, some time to read, some time to nap. And looking forward to the weather report, it's looking like it's going to be in the low to mid-50s and clear with no precipitation in Washington for the 19th, so we should have a pretty good day.
Yeah, that sounds great. Oh my goodness, that's like balmy for March for Life. That's summer weather. Okay, listen, I know there's been a big change with the change in administration. I noticed it last year. I mean, having the vice president speak was huge, but you really do feel when you get down there, you know, this really is a march to lobby our legislators and lawmakers to enact more pro-life legislation. So you really do feel like you have the ear of the administration, at least on these more recent marches.
Yeah, it would be great if our current president, aside from our vice president, could do something. I know when we were marching a few years back when President Bush was in, he would actually come on a loudspeaker, not show up personally, and send a message out that could be played to everyone there during the speech time. But, of course, it never happened with the previous administration. It would be nice if it happened with the current one. The unfortunate thing is in many years ago, I'm going back now about 15, 20 years when I started the marching in the beginning, we used to schedule appointments with our legislators, our representatives, and our senators to go to their office, but they get forewarned and usually go out of town during the march to just avoid any confrontations, and so it's been very difficult to schedule anything with our representatives or our senators. They're usually not around, so we just finish the march, go over to the Supreme Court building, stand outside and pray, and then the march ends usually around 3, and as I said, they shorten it a little bit, so it's a little bit less walking, but also not as much time in demonstrating. But I think some of the D.C. police have restricted some of the permits for where we can march so that they don't have to block as much traffic for as much a period of time. So not exactly sure what the rationale behind that is. But
it seems like it's getting shorter every year. I know. I remember the days of yore. It was a lot
shorter. Last year we started down around 7th and Constitution, and now it's around 12th. And so they keep moving it, you know, by a couple of blocks. And then you just walk from there up the first up Constitution Avenue. So it's only a 12-block walk down instead of a 20-block walk where it used to be. And so I don't know. But
Well, I think it has been a good year in terms of pro-life legislation. We've seen a lot move. And you as a doctor, and as the Catholic Medical Association president, have you been happy with the results of the past year?
Yeah, we were very happy when Tom Price, who was an orthopedic surgeon and very pro-life, got announced as the HHA secretary, but then he has since resigned and left, and we're hopeful that, we're happy that the mandate was rescinded, although now some of the states are taking the little sisters of the poor, especially the state of Pennsylvania, back to court in pursuing their obstruction to not wanting to give contraception in their health care provisions. So even though the federal government had lifted that ban, some of the states, and I don't know why specifically the new Attorney General of Pennsylvania is going after the little sisters, I think they should just leave them alone. We're anxiously awaiting what's going to happen with the Bakers out in Colorado. That Supreme Court ruling was already heard, and we should get the results sometime in the spring, and that's going to have a huge effect on our conscience rights. Of course, what's going on in California with mandating that abortion be provided in every one of the health care insurance plans was not such a happy decision that the CMA liked to hear, but we've been signing on to amicus briefs in trying to fight these battles every step of the way, and we're still anxiously awaiting for the shoe to drop, if you will, with conscience rights, and hoping that it doesn't go in the direction. I think the administration is on our side, but unfortunately the liberal judges that have been placed in some of the court positions and some of the lower courts have been making decisions that have been going against the direction that we would like to see it go in. And so the Catholic Medical Association meeting in September in Dallas, Texas this year at the Intercontinental Hotel is going to be discussing what we can do in this technocratic age of getting back to practicing medicine according to the original Hippocratic Oath, where we do not take a life and do not give any medication to terminate or end the life. And with these now 6 states that have approved euthanasia or mercy killing or physician-assisted suicide, and a couple of more states that are pending trying to get that approved. It's just an ongoing, constant battle.
Yeah, it is. All right, let's talk about some of the victories that we rolled back the Mexico City policy, which no longer allows America to fund abortions overseas, which was put in place by the former administration. I think the UN,
totally.
Yeah, the UN is moving a lot too, I think, with regards to that, with the more pro-life policy and the way it hands out its humanitarian aid to certain countries. There used to be so many strings attached with that. So I think we have some signs of hope, and we have seen some movement on the, pain effective, you can't have an abortion because the baby will feel the pain. There's legislation that's moved ahead with that. And I think I just saw that Governor John Kasich signed a bill that would make it illegal to abort a Down syndrome baby or a baby with both.
Yeah, he did. Unfortunately, our own Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania, vetoed a bill that was approved by the House and the Senate to limit abortions from 24 weeks to 20 weeks and no dismemberment abortions in Pennsylvania. And even though that was approved unanimously, or not unanimously, but majoritively by the House and the Senate, he vetoed it, and I don't think we have enough votes to override the veto. So we're still legalized to have dismemberment abortion in Pennsylvania up to 24 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, is just, it varies from state to state, and it varies from individual to individual. So it's always, you know, a difficult task. And we've had, praise be to God, the victories that we have had, and some positive affirmation on the side of a lot of the government's current government and current administration. But undoing what has been done by previous administrations, and with everything that's going on in the culture right now, it's just an uphill battle that you fight tooth and nail one step at a time. And so we still need to have as many people come and voice their opinions and their objections, and as many people pray as possible. The recent focus conference that they just finished last week in Chicago, Illinois, had over 8,000 young people from around the country come into their conference, and so that was an amazing display of a positive direction for youth that we have to look forward to going forward into the future. And the majority of the people, a significant proportion of the people that show up for the march every year are younger and younger people, and they do have other marches out on the West Coast and in St. Louis. That for people that can't make it to D.C. that also demonstrate their opposition to abortion. So
yeah, and globally, Dr. Ruppersberger, yeah. Globally, because we're seeing this now in Italy and in Ireland as well. So France. So yeah, we take the positives. We're going to get some the negatives always, but you know, we go forward. And you're right. I do think this march is such a great witness to the world. Whoever will look at how the young people view this issue, because it is, as you say, predominantly young students, college students, high school students.
Yeah, I'd encourage everybody to take off from school and go to Washington.
Yeah, you get a plenary indulgence too, by the way, if that's something you can apply to somebody you love. All right, Liz, let's talk about the book. Talk a little bit about what this book is and what inspired you to write it.
I was at a Catholic Congress in Philadelphia in 2012, and Archbishop Chaput had given a talk saying that now is the time for the new evangelization, and now is the time that lay people need to step up to the plate and reach out and evangelize. And I was having a conversation during the break with my wife, and this woman, Ellen John Giordano, was sitting across the aisle from me and heard my voice and said, "Are you Dr. Les Ruppersberger?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "Do I know you?" And she says, "Oh, no, I hear you on Catholic radio, on Holy Spirit Radio," because at the time we were still doing our NFP for Life program.
A great show.
And
yeah.
She said, "I have this idea for a book, and I need a medical consultant. And I was wondering if you would be the medical consultant." And I said, "Sure, absolutely. What kind of book are you talking about?" And she said, "I've been to a couple of theology of the body courses, and I've been to a full immersion course that was taught by Christopher West. And I have 5 children, and I was looking for a primer on how I could teach my children the truth of human sexuality as taught by the Catholic Church. And I couldn't find a book, so I decided to write one." And so she provided me with the initial script. We went back and forth with revisions in both the medical and scientific aspects, as well as some of the theological and aspects of the teachings of the church. And then she's part of a rosary group, and she met Lorraine Williams, who did all the illustrations and has a degree in art, and has been involved in calligraphy for many years. And as it turns out, ironically, Lorraine Williams is the wife, and was very well known to me personally, because she's the wife of Dr. Bill Williams, who was the editor of the Catholic Medical Association's Lineker Quarterly, as well as he was the president of the Philadelphia Guild of the Catholic Medical Association. So Bill and I had known each other, and Lorraine and Bill and Betty and I had been out to dinner and been in each other's company for many years before this. And so it was kind of ironic and a God moment that the three of us came together and were able to put this together, and then Ellen did all the legwork in making arrangements to get the Nihil Obstat from Monsignor Brandstipfield, and got the imprimatur from Archbishop Chaput. And so we couldn't find a publisher once it was all done, and so we decided to self-publish on MySpace, and none of us received any proceeds. We each selected our own individual charity. So Ellen John Giordano selected Catholic Charities of Philadelphia, Lorraine Williams selected the Little Sisters of the Poor, and I selected the Legacy of Life Foundation, which is the Crisis Pregnancy Center. And up until last year, we had sold maybe about 400 of these on MySpace. So all the monies went to those three charities. And then this year, surprisingly enough, we were approached and made arrangements through Stewardship Mission as part of the Lighthouse Media and Integrity Restored. We got picked up, and they're now publishing it and put it out there. So now it's going to be out there as one of their products. So it's for parents to share with their children age 9 and up. And it is a reflection of a biblically based theology of the body based medically accurate representation of a journey from innocence to awareness that's 100% positive on where babies come from and why God creates them the way they do, and introduces parents to the proper language for their children, and is bibliographed in the back in reference to the biblical references, and has a little story about each of the authors in the back, and all of Ellen's acknowledgments to the different people that helped her along the way. And so we, I was surprised. I never expected to have my name on the publication of a book, but it's called Wonderfully Made Babies, A Catholic Perspective on How and Why God Makes Babies for Ages 9 and Up. And so we'll see what happens with it. We just put it out there in prayer. I think that it would be extremely valuable for all of our schools to have it, and any of our children's programs, and for parents individually to get it and use it as a primer in sitting down and reading it together. And it might even surprise some of the parents, but the Integrity Restored is also a non-for-profit ministry of Stewardship, and they partnered with us, and the proceeds are going to now go to support their ongoing efforts in mission. So so we're very happy that somebody else picked it up, because it'll get out there a little bit more. And maybe this time next year, instead of 400, it'll be 4,000, and who knows where it'll go from there.
Doctor, do you get any pushback on the explicitness of the way you describe the marital embrace? I mean, I know that the language is pretty, you know, pretty clear, but maybe some parents may feel like that's a little too much. Or
we did not get any negative feedback from any of the comments anywhere, whether it was actually through Amazon, where it was originally published on MySpace, or whether it was on our Facebook or our individual emails or contact. We have not received any negative pushback or feedback from any of the people. As I said, we only sold about 400 copies of it, but I suppose that the people that purchased it had an opportunity to review it before they purchased it, so they knew what the language was. But we are really missing the boat, if you don't mind my using that phrase as a euphemism, because if we're waiting until high school, or waiting until after high school, in post-high school, graduate college, or whatever, to try to come up with a language to discuss with our children human sexuality, we are missing the boat. Theology of the body has provided us with the appropriate language, and it's our culture that has prostituted the meaning of the body and the language of the meaning of the body. And my wife and I, quite ironically, well before this book, were invited by our former pastor, who's now deceased, Monsignor Shoemaker, to teach the 7th and 8th grade chastity and abstinence programs at our parish that incorporate the 6th and the 9th commandment. And it was because the teachers and the priests were uncomfortable with the language that was brought up in the 6th and 9th commandment and the topics that were mandated to be taught in their curriculum by the archdiocese. Topics such as masturbation and lust and fornication and adultery and contraception and prostitution and rape and incest. And the teachers are uncomfortable, so they decided, well, we'll get a married couple and doctor. So we've been teaching this program for the last 7 or 8 years now, and we mandate, or the Monsignor mandated, that we give the conversation to the parents first. And Betty and I stipulated that was one of our requirements. If you wanted us to teach this class, then you need to be able to do it. And when we talk to the parents first, because they're the primary educators of their children, and when we get in there, some of the parents will be upset and say, well, don't you think it's a little soon? Don't you think it's a little, you know, kind of forward, and maybe we shouldn't go so strong? Well, these are the commandments that were given to us by God, the 6th and the 9th commandment, that had to do specifically, 2 of the commandments, with our human sexuality and our behavior. And if we don't give them the appropriate language in a Catholic school at a time when these children are going through puberty, then where are they going to get the language? And what language are they going to get? And so one of the ironies of the, if you want to call it, the boldness of the language and theology of the body and the beauty of the human body and the marital embrace is that why are there slang words for male and female genital anatomy, but there are no slang words for your elbow or your knee or your nose or your ear or other parts of the body? And we talk about that with the children, and they were kind of amazed that there are appropriate and proper language words to refer to that, and because they are so special and because they are so holy, they're almost sacramental, it's sacred. And that's what the theology of the body is all about. It's actually a theology. It's actually God speaking to us and allowing us to participate in the Trinitarian type of love that's shared between the Father and the Son, that it actually leads to the formation of the Holy Spirit, which is the Lord, the giver of life. We say that in our creed every Sunday at Mass, and yet nobody balks at saying, I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life. Oh, there we are again, talking about, you know, bringing new life into the world in the Nicene Creed. Mm-hmm. And yet, this is what it's all about. So Ellen took that language and put it into the appropriate medically used anatomic words, and this is the time, if not earlier, to be actually having that conversation with your children, teaching them what those body, you teach them, you potty train them, you teach them how to eat, you teach them table manners, you teach them all kinds of things at age appropriate. Some parents do balk, you know, and say their children aren't ready for that, and that's up to the parents to decide. But we just wanted to make available something that would introduce the language and introduce the story and allow them to be able to have the conversation. And so we think that's what this book does.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it really, it's the theology of the body probably boiled down for many adults who have never even been able to crack through the sort of the more dense adult books on this. This is a good primer on that teaching by our most blessed and Saint John Paul II.
Absolutely.
A teaching for our time.
You know, Christopher West says it's a time bomb waiting to go off in this century, and I'm still waiting for it to go off. And it is working its way a little bit more into various curriculum in elementary and high school and some college courses, but just not enough. It needs to be incorporated with the catechism at an early age. And, you know, when you take a look at statistics and you take a look at 12-year-olds in the United States and you see that 1 in 8 12-year-olds are sexually active, then how old are you what grade are you in when you're 12? 6th, 7th grade? And so 7th and 8th grade teaching, you know, the 6th and the 9th commandment, and it may be a little bit too late. So when we were discussing, you know, the age to put in the introduction and the foreword, like, you know, what age is this appropriate for, the original age that Ellen had was about 12. And I said, no, it needs to be moved back to 9 because 12 is too late. We're missing the boat. These children are out there. They are constantly inundated by pornographic and inappropriate language and literature on the internet, television, radio, song, in our media, everywhere else. So why would it be uncomfortable or inappropriate for parents to be sitting down with their children first and teaching them the truth about the meaning of their bodies rather than letting them hear it from somewhere else, another teacher, another educational program, a school, or their friends on media, on the internet. So
yeah, absolutely. That is a parent's responsibility. And I think that many parents just automatically assume if they put their child in CCD or send them to a Catholic school that you know, somehow this is going to be talked about and taken care of. Really, it's an ongoing conversation, and it's an ongoing point at which a parent should never hesitate to bring these wonderful truths to their children. As you say, Verles, I think now, I think 80% of boys, pre-high school have already experienced and are experiencing pornography. We have an explosion in our country and an explosion in all. It goes through all income levels, regardless of religion. It is a huge problem. It's a huge problem going forward. And, this is maybe an anecdote to some of that. And it's just, again, reiterating, parents really need to educate themselves and sit down with their children and start introducing the truths of the Catholic faith to them. And I really applaud the effort that you have made in this regard and ongoing efforts that you will make. Lesk, I can't let you go without talking about Humanae Vitae and the sort of semi-controversy that's swirling around this with regards to the 50th year anniversary and whether or not we're going to see some sort of movement from the highest levels in the church to maybe scale this back.
Well, I hope and pray to God that it doesn't. You know, there was a lot of controversy, and unfortunately, a lot of Catholics, especially today, really don't know the story behind Humanae Vitae, which was the commission. You know, during Vatican II, there was a discussion that perhaps the Catholic Church needed to loosen its teachings on contraception. And so John the 23rd appointed a commission of experts from all over the world. And unfortunately, he passed away before the commission had finished its work. Paul VI was elected the next pope. He expanded the commission knowing that this was an important aspect and topic that the Catholic Church needed to address. And so now 80 or 90 experts from all over the world, theologians, physicians, moralists, ethicists, physiologists, endocrinologists, people from the Catholic Medical Association, everywhere were looking at this topic. And unbeknownst to a lot of people, there were two opinions that were written. There was a majority opinion that was given to Paul VI, and then there was a minority opinion. And on the minority opinion's board was this cardinal from Poland by the name of Karol Wojtyla, who would later become Pope and write theology of the body. And so now the Pope has these two opinions, and he takes it under prayerful discernment through the Holy Spirit, and on the Feast of St. James on July 25th, 1968, proclaims Humanae Vitae, a very short 15-page encyclical that literally has some infallibility attached to it as coming as a teaching of the magisterium of the Church. And there was uproar around the world. There were protests on the steps of Catholic University, cardinals, bishops, priests, nuns, religious, lay people, and it divided everyone in the Catholic Church. So much so, personally, in the history of the Catholic Medical Association, in 1967, we had 10,000 members. And in 1968, when Humanae Vitae was released, we dropped down. By 1990, we had 500 members from 10,000.
Wow.
And every one of the physicians that left left the Catholic Medical Association because they could not deal with the teaching of the church on contraception. And of course, the pill came on the market in 1960, and it became a staple of medical care in the 1970s, 1980s, the 1990s. It still is. I personally, my own personal story was that I prescribed it for 21 years of my practice before my conversion in 1999. And it was, you know, a Catholic priest confronting me personally and asking me whether or not I prescribed contraception in my practice. When I said yes, he wanted to know how I could reconcile doing that and receiving communion on Sundays. And I did not have an answer, but had, you know, an attack of conscience. So the following Sunday after that confrontation, I could not, in good conscience, get up and receive communion. And it took me 6 months of personal discernment and agonizing to where my wife and I sold our home, downsized our lives, changed our practice. We had 2 children in college. I mean, the story, you know, goes on and on, but every one of these other physicians were agonizing. How can I do this? What's going to happen to my practice, my job? People want this. This is, you know. So we are, now it has fallen to the point where it, you know, a lot of people don't know about it. A lot of people don't learn about it. But in that encyclical, Paul VI did reach out to healthcare providers, did reaffirm before theology of the body was ever written, meaning of the body and the meaning of human sexuality and the meaning of intimacy, did say that for medical purposes, if it was necessary, that the hormonal contraceptive could be prescribed, but for short periods of time and only for treatment under the principle of double effect, but that, you know, periodic continence and natural family planning could be utilized by couples in the discernment of responsible parenthood. So it set the stage for a lot of different things. The first NFP class wasn't taught until 6 years later in 1974 in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And so prior to that, natural family planning was very minimally known to couples, and it's still very minimally known to couples. And so this has been the 50-year teaching and staple where every other Christian church in the world has embraced the freedom to contracept through whatever means, including sterilization. But the Catholic Church, the Muslim religion, and the Orthodox Jewish religion are the only 3 major religions in the world that continue to teach that contraception is not appropriate in the meaning of the body and the meaning of human sexuality in a marital relationship. And it is intended only for a marital relationship, despite the fact that we have a lot of cohabitation and a lot of other things going on outside of marriage. But when you look at the Catholic Church, 85% of Catholics do not accept the teaching and contracept, whereas over 90% of Muslims are faithful to the teachings of their faith. And so the average number of children that Christian families are having, it varies throughout the world, but if you look in the United States, we're at a birth rate of 1.7 without the Hispanic population. With the Hispanic population, we come up to 2.1, which is zero population growth, whereas Muslims average having 5 children in their family because they're not contracepting. So one of the fastest growing faiths or religions in the world is the Muslim religion because they're not contracepting, whereas the Christian and Catholic churches are contracepting themselves out of existence. And we see that now with articles such as the demographic winner that you see in European countries that were predominantly Catholic that are now being overtaken by other faiths because of their beliefs and what teachings they follow. So reminding everyone of the beauty of the language of what Paul VI has given us in 1968 and reaffirming that through celebrations throughout the year is certainly appropriate, but I think it's going to meet with the same type of resistance because we've been living in a contraceptive culture of death for so many years. And, you know, people, my personal opinion is that abortion is horrible, and we go and march for the last 44 years against abortion in Washington, D.C., with the March for Life. But abortion is only one of the branches, and the root of the tree of abortion is contraception. And so people don't want a child, and so they contracept. And when their contraceptive doesn't work, they still don't want a child. Their only alternative is abortion. And so 50% of women who are having abortions in the United States were using some form of contraception.
Yeah.
And so every one of the contraceptives has a failure rate. And so it doesn't make any difference how high the numbers get to be. The failure rate with the pill is 1%. If there's 10 million women on the pill, it fails 1% of 10 million. If there's 15 million women on the pill, it fails 1% of 15 million. So there's still women that are wanting abortions because they didn't want to have children. And they don't know the meaning of sexuality, and they don't realize that sex makes babies.
Well, and beyond that, yeah, and beyond that, too, I mean, it's just the objectification of women, the ability that you could have sexual relations outside of marriage, disconnecting the intimacy and the fruitfulness of the act and the invitation of God to be in that union. I mean, there's such a host of problems that come out from that, and it never has helped women. And as a woman, I mean, I don't even know, medically speaking, why anyone would take a pill to stop a natural function in your body. So many studies have come out, New York Times, just saying about the link between birth control and breast cancer. And we certainly know that blood clots and so many horrible stories of young women taking this.
Well, it's not women's health care, and all you need to do is pick up, and I would challenge anyone out there that has an opinion opposite. All one needs to do is pick up the package insert that is printed and published by the company that manufactures the product. And in the package insert, so that they cover themselves medical legally, they list the increased risk of breast cancer, heart attack, stroke, blood clots, gallbladder disease, liver tumors, cervical cancer. And now in the American Journal of Psychology about 3 months ago, I think it was October of 2017, they published an article showing that there is an increased risk of suicide associated with women that are on the pill. And as we know, suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teenagers and people in their early 20s. And a lot of these girls have not only the side effects of depression and biochemical changes in the brain associated with being on hormonal contraception, but they are forced into this, what they call a dissociative state, where they separate their executive selves to rationalize why they should give themselves as a gift in sexuality outside of marriage to someone that they're not going to be with permanently.
Wow.
And women,
Les,
women
that's
have
fascinating.
Hormonal connections with oxytocin that bond these women with these men that they're sexually active with, where men do not. And so they become depressed after being left, if you will, when the relationship is over. And they do that repetitively over and over again, to where you look at numbers where the average 24-year-old woman in the United States has had at least 5 partners by age 24.
Wow.
So how many times do you give the gift, and what is the meaning of the gift, and what is the value of the gift if you keep giving it over and over again and keep getting rebuffed and rejected each and every time? What happens to you mentally, emotionally, psychologically? So when you read these articles and they have proof, and now with abortion as being a follow-up to failed contraception, and with we do 1 million abortions a year in the United States. India does 15.6 million abortions every year in India. And what we see with the one-child policy in China, which was just reversed because of what they've done to their population, we are seeing epidemics of breast cancer in China and in India as a result of the abortions that are being done.
Mm.
And so we have 20 and 30 years worth of medical scientific fact showing that even though people try to justify and rationalize their behavior, that biochemically the pill and the hormonal IUD, both as abortive fashions as well as surgical abortion and the morning after pill, are destroying and ruining women's lives and families. And it's not women's health care. And you don't need to go any further than pull out the package insert from the company that makes the product. And if the product warns you, if you buy a microwave oven and it tells you that if you put metal into it, it might explode, well, people don't put metal into microwave ovens. Then if you buy a birth control pill and it tells you that you increase your risk of breast cancer, and we have an epidemic of breast cancer in the United States, then why are women putting this into their bodies? And why are doctors prescribing it? You can't get it in this country without a prescription. So it's the doctors that are creating the problem. So at the Catholic Medical Association level, we're working with healthcare professionals to try to stop it and try to tell everyone that this is not good healthcare. But it's, as I said earlier, a totally uphill battle because the majority of secular medical literature that's coming out says there's no problem.
Mm. That's a fascinating topic, and I would love to interview you further on this whole idea with regards to the hormonal and the depressive. I have not yet heard that, so that is an interesting topic I want to pursue further with you. We are unfortunately out of time, but I just so much appreciate you making the time available. Again, the book is called Wonderfully Made. It's written by Dr. Les Ruppersberger, and it's available.
Wonderfully Made Babies.
And where is it available, Les, if people want to buy this?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com, and you can get it through Stewardships, their organization called Integrity Restored. It is at integrityrestored.org, or you can just Google,
Integrity
Stewardship.
Stewardship, okay.
.org, and Lighthouse Media has it available, but Amazon's probably the easiest place that people can go and just type in Wonderfully Made Babies and it'll come up. And I think right now it's about $12 since Integrity Restored took it over. It was $10, but I guess the printing costs went up a little bit in the last 3 years. But again, all the money and all the proceeds go to a not-for-profit, so they're deductible and the information is just invaluable. And I gave my kids copies of it a couple of years ago. I have 10 grandchildren. And I try to give it out to any of my nieces and nephews that might be interested. And so they make great gifts with any, time coming up. And I'd say from the fourth grade on up, it's the appropriate time to sit down and read this book a little bit at a time. And the parents will learn something as well as the children. So.
No doubt. All right, Dr. Les, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All righty.
Take care. God bless.
All right. Bye-bye.
Mindlessly in circles. from the doubts in my head. And everywhere I go, I wonder where I'm going. I wonder if I'm showing everything that must be seen. And it surprises me to know that he answers all my questions just by strongly saying to me, be still and know I am God. Oh, be still and know I am God.
Good morning. This morning we're speaking with Megan Coakley, the director of the Office for the New Evangelization for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Welcome, Megan.
Hi, Barbara.
It's so nice to know as we contemplate this new year and this winter sort of is upon us. Sometimes it kind of gets you down, but you're giving a great warming tea coming up at Malvern in February, talking about feminine genius. And Megan, we were speaking about how the culture right now is kind of confused. There's such division between men and women, especially with the ongoing problem of pornography and sexual harassment. Talk a little bit about what feminine genius is and what it's meant to be for Catholic women and all women in the world today.
Yeah, well, I think it starts out with, I mean, any account of the feminine genius has to account for the Church's total vision of the human person, which includes the masculine. So I mean, one of the words that comes to me right away is John Paul II's quote, that the dignity and the balance of all of civilization depends on who woman will be for man and who man will be for woman. So that kind of mutual needing of each other, this mutual reverence before each other, is really at the heart of civilization, and that actually civilization is only stable and it's only secure if men and women, number one, recognize each other's gifts and then reverence them and value them. So it starts there with any kind of talk of the feminine genius. You always have in your mind that there's always going to be a corresponding masculine genius that's always being kind of illumined. So anytime we're illuminating what's beautiful about women, it's going to then kind of complementarily illumine what's beautiful about men, which is going to be something different. And that's what we love about it, that there is distinction, but there is equality and dignity. So we'll start there. But this particular tea is going to be specifically about the feminine genius. I think there's definitely a lot of talk in the culture about women's gifts, but I would say they tend to be very superficial, and frequently they don't tend to actually be talking about the uniqueness of women at all. It's just kind of women need more power, and women need more money, and women need more of this and that, which is not the feminine genius. The feminine genius is what are the unique gifts that women have been given by God that they bring that are unrepeatable. In other words, that men don't bring, that women bring, and that we are necessary and we have to be a part of everything that's going on in society, whether it be within the family, within a marriage, in the workplace, and certainly within the church, that we have a unique gift to give. So the talk is going to be about that. What are those gifts? Because we can talk about that, but we need to know what are they. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about how women can get there, because we have been given these gifts, but a lot of times they are covered over by sin, by our brokenness, by ignorance even. And so how do we begin the journey of it?
Now, this term feminine genius was given by Pope John Paul II, now St. John Paul II. Why did he think it was necessary to term this a genius?
Well, I think John Paul II certainly noticed in the culture this kind of feminism that was really has been going on since the 50s and 60s. And I think he was noticing that, unfortunately, what was happening with feminism is it was really just, it wasn't actually an affirmation of women. What was happening was it was just kind of insisting that women just take on masculine qualities and somehow that's how they gain their dignity. And so John Paul II wanted to, what he called the new feminism, he wanted a new understanding of women that proceeds from Christ's own love and reverence for women, and to articulate so that we really can have a movement on behalf of women, but that we need one that's actually authentically feminine.
Right.
And so John Paul II was really the genius on kind of asking Catholic women to launch a new movement of being pro-woman, but that is actually authentically for women.
Megan, we are coming up on the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. which is the church teaching on the beauty and dignity of the marital embrace and the idea that we leave, let God be in those embraces. But with the advent of hormonal contraception, I think women have become confused in terms of their sexual identity, in terms of the fact that you know, they're equal to men in terms of their ability to hook up, but yet they're confused when the pornographic culture treats them and degrades them. So there is a tremendous confusion, especially among young women, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it kind of goes along with the same lines of this notion that, unfortunately, feminism took a wrong turn, and it just started to say that women gain dignity or they are only valued when they express I would say like masculine traits, but not even masculine. They're kind of fake masculine, so aggressive, powerful, dominating. And so that really goes along with the contraceptive mentality as well, because basically what's happening with birth control is that women and men are both being degendered, right, ungendered, and particularly women, in a sense, birth control is an affront to their femininity because it's basically asking them to defeminize, to become not women, and that's, unfortunately, the message is that's the only way you're valued. And then the corresponding problem with that is, you know, on the one hand, the message is you're going to be liberated from your commitments, you're going to be liberated from family, and that's how you're going to gain respect. But then, just as you're pointing out, what's actually happened with the whole sexual revolution is that women have actually lost ground as far as their dignity and their being reverenced is concerned. As you notice, women are primarily the subject of the objectification that's happening in pornography. So women have actually, I would say, really been thrust even further down the ladder because of the kind of lust-filled culture that has been generated by contraception. So it's a very profound deception that's going on, and so all the more does the church really have to embrace humanae vitae and be confident about it, be confident about what Paul VI said about contraception and what it's doing to women, what it's doing to families, what it's doing to our happiness. So I think that's where the church and we as women can be very prophetic for one another to find the path to true dignity and not and help people avoid the false one.
Megan, with the explosion of pornography, how easy is it for young women to live out this Catholic feminine genius? At what point do you compromise? At what point do you say it's just too impossible?
If a woman is going to make the decision to live the authentic feminine genius, which means she's going to not be presenting herself as an object for sexual gratification to men, if she's going to choose that and choose authentic dignity and relationships, she is very likely to be alone. In other words, to not probably very often have a boyfriend. Not necessarily, but I would say that there is going to be a real cross there. And unless a woman is then firmly grounded in intimacy with Jesus Christ, unless she is experiencing him loving her and his gaze of love that's seeing her beauty and affirming her lovableness, it's going to be very easy for her to succumb to the lies of the culture. And so what Catholic women need to do, if we really want to live the feminine genius and refuse the lies of the culture and refuse to present ourselves as sexual objects for being used, we're going to need to have that intimacy with Jesus Christ and be being loved by him often through prayer and the sacraments. And then also we have to have a good community in our parishes or in our campuses, because without that love coming in, right, our hearts become very vulnerable to then seeking love in the wrong ways.
And I can speak to married women who may be attending this tea. How is it that they can be great lights and witnesses to this feminine genius in our culture and for other young mothers that they are going to be coming across?
Well, I would say for married women, the journey and the task of becoming a good wife, I mean, kind of beyond solving all the culture's problems, the first thing is to really devote yourself to a good marriage. Now, regardless of where your husband is at, there's a lot that a woman can do, number one, in her own heart, right? So being unafraid to pursue healing from her own personal brokenness, from wounds of the past, from sexual sins in the past, really embarking on that journey of healing and holiness. And the more a woman becomes whole, the more capable of love she becomes. And that's really what radiates. That is what convinces people that what the Christian message has to say is viable and doable. So I would say actually, like, it's a very simple answer, which is to become, in a sense, what John Paul II said, is become who you are, and kind of be courageous about that. Be courageous about facing what is inside of us that's blocking the feminine genius, that's preventing our capacity for love. And then, of course, outwardly from there, become a beautiful mom if you have children. Become an excellent friend. Be an excellent sister. And all of those things are only possible when, again, we are in union with Christ, when we are first being loved. That's going to be the first part of the talk. It's just the need for a woman to be loved. And then she becomes capable of loving.
And our last question, Megan, for people, women who are raising young girls and young adult women, how important is it to fight those battles on modes of dress and telephone and cell phone time and smartphone, social media interaction? How important is it for mothers to hear this message? Sometimes it feels like it's overwhelming in the culture to fight the battle.
Yeah. I mean, well, this is where moms, when they themselves are experiencing conversion, when they are experiencing love from the Lord, and have a good community, they're supported then in being kind of strong with their daughters, because obviously the curbing of technology, especially, which is it's a real danger, especially for the young, because what it's doing is it's teaching them to relate in a way that's not fully human. You know, it's very electronic, and we're losing our capacity for physical presence and just spending time with one another, talking and making eye contact. Moms have to be really strong on this, and it's going to be tough because they're going to get a lot of resistance from their daughters. But I think it's not a matter of just laying down a law. It's having real conversations about these things, and also just introducing their daughters to the concept of the feminine genius. And with that, I think the concept of really authentic relationships, which very often happen off of the phone. So there's a kind of strength and courage required of mothers right now. And that's where I think the community support is also going to be really important.
We've been speaking with Megan Coakley. She is the director of the Office for the New Evangelization for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And you don't want to miss this upcoming tea that Megan is going to be speaking at Malvern Retreat House in Malvern. Megan, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Barbara.